Welcome, everyone, to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley, a national news and talk program dedicated to military veterans issues. And now, your hosts, David Corey and Richard Hurley.
Good evening. Welcome to the Veterans News Hour for September the 18th, 2017. This is David Corey, along with my co-host, Richard Hurley. Thanks for joining us this evening. Hello, Richard.
Hey, David. How are you tonight? And welcome to our listeners this evening. Yes, indeed, we do have a special guest in tonight's show. Our guest is Brian Meyer of the Veterans Community Project, located in Kansas City, Missouri. I want to remind everyone that this is a call-in show that welcomes your views, comments, and questions. So you can call us at any time during the show at 1-888-627-6008. Again, the toll-free call-in number is 1-888-627-6008. Back to you, David.
Thanks, Richard. I'd like to introduce our special guest tonight. Brian Meyer is the Chief Legal Officer of the Veterans Community Project of Kansas City, Missouri. He is a former Marine Corps helicopter crew chief. During his time in the Marines, he was attached to the Marine Medium Helicopter Squadron 355. He deployed to Iraq in March of 2003. He participated in Operation Shining Express, which was support of rescue efforts of the U.S. Embassy during the Second Liberian Civil War. And he also deployed a second time to Iraq in August of 2004. During these deployments, his unit provided assault support and casualty evacuation. After the Marine Corps, Brian moved back home to Kansas City, where he attended the University of Missouri at Kansas City, earning a master's degree in public administration and a law degree. Brian worked as a practicing attorney at a Kansas City law firm until leaving to co-found Veterans Community Project. He is also active with the Kansas City Metropolitan Bar Association, Military Matters Operating Committee, and the UMKC School of Law Young Alumni Association. So without further ado, I welcome our special guest, Brian Meyer, to the Veterans News Hour. How are you, Brian?
I'm doing well. Thank you.
Well, thanks for being on our show tonight. We have lots to talk about tonight. But why don't we begin by you telling us some more about your military service and then what inspired you to help co-found the Veterans Community Project?
Sure. You know, my military service was a little, different. So I joined right after high school, and that was actually just to date me a little bit. I was in boot camp during September 11th, so I kind of joined before the dramatic shift, that you will, in our foreign policy and in everything that's transpired since. My military service was fantastic. It really left an impression on me and probably dramatically changed the course of my life.
I see. Can you tell us more about your service? I know you had two deployments in Iraq and also in support of the rescue effort of the U.S. Embassy from the Second Liberian War, which I will have to admit, although I'm a veteran myself and a real someone up to speed on military, I have to tell you, I wasn't familiar with that particular operation. Could you tell us more about those, maybe share some war stories with us and our listeners?
Well, I don't know that any war stories I have are particularly that interesting. I mean, as a helicopter guy and as an enlisted guy, it was just a lot of long days and long nights, followed by, you know, flying missions and kind of whatever was expected of us. I think sometimes when people hear I was an attorney or went to college, they assume that maybe I was an officer, but I was just a enlisted guy, kind of lower on the totem pole, one of the bigger mix. In terms of Shining Express, on the way back from our first deployment, we were diverted for an embassy evacuation, and that really wasn't anything too substantial. in of itself, but it was an interesting experience to bring basically, you know, American civilians or the employees of the embassy onto a boat full of a bunch of Marines that had just come out of Iraq for the first time.
I see. Now, you spent two different tours in Iraq, and I know you sound very humble and kind of downplaying, you know, your war experience. And by war stories, I didn't mean necessarily anything extraordinary or dramatic, but just what was it like? Just share with our listeners, what was it like, even on a day-to-day basis, in Iraq? You know, how I know you were there in 2003 and again in 2004. Maybe you can share with us your perspective of how things were going as far as the war at that point, what your unit, what you were involved in, even on just a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, so when we got there on the first deployment, we went into Kuwait, and basically it was kind of entrenching ourselves because at that time, you know, we hadn't actually started a military campaign. So we were kind of sitting in Kuwait and preparing and, you know, not knowing what was going to happen. And by not knowing what's going to happen, I even mean to the point, you know, before we really truly realized that chemical warfare was out of the question or anything like that, there was a lot of nights spent waking up in the middle of the night and throwing on a gas mask and jumping in a crudely dug hole in the ground because the threat was still active. And then, of course, after we actually launched the military campaign, we pushed forward and pushed forward up until about the point of just outside of Baghdad. And then by that time, we had been there long enough, it was time to rotate out. It was kind of a little bit of a wild, wild west experience, meaning that, you know, there wasn't a whole lot of order in place. Now, that I mean order in a relative term, because anytime it's military, there's order. But I'm just saying it in comparison to when I returned for the second time and we were much more established and actually, you know, had bases and buildings and roads. It was very different. So, you know, really the day-to-day was wake up and do whatever was required of you that day and do it the best you could and go to sleep and do it again. And actually, time can fly when you're doing that. So, you know, it's an interesting experience for sure.
Now, if you could, our listeners, primarily a veteran audience and veteran families, and also those just interested in the military, those served in the military from all different MOS career fields, if you will. Can you tell us more about what it's like being a helicopter crew chief in the Marine Corps?
Yeah, so basically half your time is divided between maintenance and upkeep of the aircraft, and the other half of your time is spent as air crew during flights. So what that means is the particular aircraft I was on is a TH-46, which is actually now retired, but usually carried a crew of either four or five, and, you know, myself and the other crew kind of in the back of the helicopter were responsible for the onloading, offloading, as well as one of the things that you probably, most people don't realize is, you know, a helicopter, especially that size, when it gets below a certain height, pilots are kind of blind. So at a certain point every flight, we would have to manually guide the pilots as to where to go, saying, you know, forward, back, left, right, up, down, those types of things. But that was really it. It was keep the aircraft flying and, when necessary, go be part of that crew.
Right. And how many troops or Marines could a CH-46 carry?
So I believe the stated capacity is a four-person crew with 12 fully loaded Marines or soldiers, whatever that happens to be. I can say that we've definitely pushed those limits a couple times and put on more than that. it can also, what can also play in is whatever your fuel load is, meaning putting on more fuel, taking off less fuel to make the aircraft heavier or lighter, depending on the distance you have to fly. So there's some creative ways to get as many people as possible on those aircraft. It's about the size, I tell people for reference, it was probably about the size of a school bus.
I see. Except with rotor blades. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yep.
Now, we had on one of our prior shows a door gunner who flew in what he called a smoke ship back in Vietnam, smoke ship where they would lay out a cloud of smoke when they were approaching a landing zone or going to recover troops from a pickup zone. Was the CH-43, were they armed with, let's say, door gunners or other types of weapons?
Yeah, so the two crew in the back, we were each responsible for a 50 caliber machine gun out of either side, left or right, respectively. We didn't do a whole lot of smoking out our landing zones or taking off or anything like that in Iraq. But yeah, we were absolutely responsible for that aspect of it.
I see. Well, thanks for enlightening us about that, Brian. I know my co-host Richard has some questions for you, so over to you, Richard.
Well, good evening, Brian. How are you tonight?
I'm well, sir. How are you?
I see that you're active with the Young Lawyers Association.
I am, yeah. I really, really enjoyed my law school experience, so I try to stay involved as much as possible.
That's awesome. Yeah, when I was a younger lawyer up in New Jersey, I was very active with the State Young Lawyers Association as well as the County Bar Association and got a lot out of it, especially a lot of the community projects that we did associated with that group. And speaking of community projects, you got involved with the Veterans Community Project. Can you tell us something about that?
Sure. So the Veterans Community Project is a nonprofit organization based out of Missouri, and our goal is to end veteran homelessness in our area by providing a community of tiny houses as transitional housing for homeless veterans. Ultimately, the idea is to start with a house, bring a street homeless veteran in, give them a house, and provide all the on-site services that might be necessary to address whatever issues put them in the homeless position.
And what motivated you to start I guess you call it the VCP?
Mm-hmm. So actually, I can't, I had assisted start an organization that was providing veterans free legal service. And through that organization, I met one of the other co-founders, Chris Stout, who at the time was the Veteran Outreach Coordinator for the United Way. And he would often lean on me to assist veterans, him being a veteran himself, with legal issues or matters, things like that. Through his work with the homeless population, he became a little, for lack of a better word, frustrated with existing programming. And between him, myself, and a couple of other co-founders, we got together and said, you know, there might be a different model, a different way to go about this, and maybe we should try that. We don't want to continue to struggle to get assistance to people that we very much feel a personal connection to as other veterans. So that's kind of what this idea of tiny houses was born out of.
That's awesome. Now, you started this in Kansas City, and you know we have veterans all over the country, as we all know. And some areas have more veterans than others, like Florida, for instance. We've got an enormous population of veterans down here. Is there something unique about Kansas City that the VCP found necessary to help out the group of veterans that are there in Kansas City?
To be honest, it started in Kansas City. There is very unique things about Kansas City. However, the reason it started in Kansas City is simply because all the co-founders are from Kansas City. And we were committed to helping our community at large. It wasn't necessarily a selection, and I think that when we kind of rolled this idea out and our ambitions, you know, we thought that we would help our community. We didn't necessarily know that the response from other places would be so great and kind of make us think about expanding the programming into other areas.
And when you say into other areas, can you kind of go into more detail about the other areas?
Yeah, so we're still building our village here in Kansas City. We're still kind of creating a blueprint because we are trying to do something that hasn't really been done. So it takes a little bit of time, and admittedly we make some mistakes, but we're getting there. And the idea is once we have our village up and running in Kansas City with all the houses we intend to have there, all the social services, that will expand out into other cities. And we hope to grow this into something that can be replicated in any major metropolitan city or any city that has the appropriate resources and population of need, because we think that it is needed in a lot of places.
I'm located near a place in Florida called The Villages. I'm not sure if you're familiar with it or not. It's near the Ocala, Florida area. And in The Villages, it's a huge community of non-veterans and veterans, but they have a huge veteran population there, and what you're describing is similar to what they've been doing. Have you ever heard of The Villages in Florida?
I know that the name sounds familiar, but I couldn't name their programming off the top of my head.
Yeah, that's good. David, what about you? I know you had some additional questions.
Yeah, I have some other questions. Brian, if you would, you started. You mentioned that Kansas City is known for a lot of things, and unfortunately, I personally have never been to Kansas City. I'd like to visit there someday. I know it's the location of the National World War I Memorial. Isn't that correct?
It is, and I was actually just there on Saturday night. They were having an event down there as a fundraiser. They've actually been a great supporter of our organization, and the World War I Museum is really kind of a hidden gem. It's an incredible facility. It receives an incredible amount of support from the community at large. The people that work there are passionate, and what they have is just second to none. The amount of history they retell and the memorabilia they have, it's really incredible. And they kind of, you know, drove something home this past weekend, which is, you know, we've lost all of our veterans from World War I. So it may be easy to kind of let some of that go by because there aren't, you know, people currently around that served in it. But that kind of makes it even that much more important to remember that war and everything that it meant.
Well, I was impressed by the fact that Kansas City is the home of the National World War I Memorial. You know, they have so many national memorials in Washington D.C. along the Mall. They have the Vietnam Wall there. And not too many years ago, they built the World War II memorial, and they've got National History Museum, a lot of other things there, and Space Museum. But can you give us kind of a description of the World War I Memorial and the museum there? What does it look like? You know, how large is it? Just give us a sense of what that is like.
Yeah, sure. So the memorial itself, so I guess we're talking about, you know, two different things. They're on the same location, the memorial and the museum. So the memorial is a tower that is straight up. I'd be probably pretty off if I tried to guesstimate how tall it really is, but it stands above the entire city skyline. And what's really neat about it is that there's a gas flame on top that runs 24/7, and that's really the memorial itself. The museum is actually built into the ground under the memorial, and it's extremely large and well done. And it actually became the registered site as the World War One Museum Memorial just a few years ago, actually. I believe the name of the tower itself is called Liberty Tower. I'm assuming it's at least 200 feet high. It's probably no more than 250. But it's really a sight to see.
Wow. Do you know how it was located? I know President Harry Truman had connections to Kansas City, and he served in combat in World War One. Did he play any role by chance? If you know how the decision was made to locate the National World War One Memorial and Museum there.
You know, I feel like I should have a great answer to that. I don't. I believe that it had a lot to do with some prominent people in the area really pushing hard for it. I think it might have been a situation where, okay, there's a good amount of support and philanthropist money in the area to assist and kind of kick this off. But it wouldn't surprise me at all if any political connections to the area played a part in it.
I see. And again, for the benefit of our listeners who've never been to Kansas City, and I think the National World War One Memorial and Museum would be fantastic reasons to visit Kansas City. But what else is Kansas City known for? You know, how many people live there? What are its major industries and businesses? And if you could tell us more about the size of the veteran population, and then kind of tie that into, you know, the purpose of your organization and mostly helping the homeless veteran population. Can you speak to those things, please?
Sure. So first and foremost, I think most people know Kansas City for its barbecue, which is absolutely fantastic. But I think barbecue jazz, maybe. Those are things, barbecue jazz, baseball, if I had to name the top three. But what might go under the radar is the size of Kansas City. The size of Kansas City is a metropolitan area. It's really a regional area. And, you know, most of the time you say Kansas City, I think a lot of people think, oh, that's in Kansas. Well, it's actually in Missouri. It's right on state line. But the entire region, the metro region, is all really interconnected. Most people live in one state, work in the other. It's kind of an interesting study when it comes to that idea of regionalism and supporting different things. You can look at most of the attractions and businesses and, you know, sports teams are on the Missouri side of state line, but most of the housing and kind of shopping developments are on the Kansas side of it. So it's an interesting mixture. In terms of the veteran population, I think last I looked for the overall veteran population, if we're talking for the metro area, is the mid 350 to 375. If you get more narrow when it comes to the homeless veteran population, that really goes to how you might define what a veteran is or how you might define what homeless is. So that's probably a maybe
when you say 350 to 375, you mean like how many, like 350,000, 375,000? What were you referring
to?
Yeah,
I'm sorry. Yeah, 350, 375,000 in the metro area. Now, the Kansas City metro area is very large. By mileage, it's one of the largest, not by population density.
As far as population, what's kind of the rough estimate of a population for the entire metropolitan area? Roughly. This isn't a test.
I know. I feel like I should have done my homework for this one. I believe
Like a million, two million.
I don't want to be way too off on this, but I believe 2.5 million for what's considered the metro area.
I see. Well, that helps. It's just I just want to kind of give our audience a sense of what Kansas City is like, and you've done a great job. I want to thank you for doing that. I know a lot of sports fans, you know, follow the football team, the baseball team, and as you say, Kansas City is known for barbecue and for jazz. What would you say are some of the major industries and businesses in that area? And have you found them to be supportive of the veteran community and specifically your project?
Yeah, so, you know, Kansas City actually has a really diverse corporate community. There's some really, like, I'd say probably the biggest one now, the one that makes all the headlines, would be Cerner. Honeywell has a huge presence here. There's also a pretty good population of large national law firms here. All that aside, Kansas City ranks very highly, I believe, in the top 10 on the scale that ranks giving or charitable areas. And the community at large has just been overwhelmingly supportive of what we're trying to do.
Well, that's great. And I wanted to give you an opportunity, if you would, to go in a little more detail about the Veterans Village and the Tiny Homes Project that you have. I've in my work as a lawyer and helping veterans, I've had the occasion over the years to visit a number of homeless shelters in the Tampa Bay area, including some that were pretty much exclusively for veterans and some that were for homeless people and families having nothing to do with veteran status. And some of them, quite frankly, are pretty rough places, you know, but there's one on the other hand. There's a veterans residential facility in Clearwater, Florida, that even some veterans themselves would probably call it, like, you know, as far as a homeless shelter, kind of a five-star homeless shelter. It was created and funded by some businessmen who really wanted to kind of repay the veterans, but nice facility, nice looking facility, good food, programs to help the veterans. But one thing that I've heard from some veterans is the fact that they still feel institutionalized there. So I'm intrigued with your idea of giving veterans more independence by giving them their own individual home and, you know, what you call tiny homes. Could you describe that for us?
Sure. So I'll start with the tiny home itself. The tiny home itself, 240 square feet, which may not sound a lot, but anybody who's ever stepped in one has said that it seems much larger than what you would imagine. Each house is on a concrete foundation connected to city sewer, city water, city electric. I mean, a lot of people maybe have the misconception that they're on trailers or it's mobile somehow, and that's just not the case. They're really just small homes. They meet every code that any sort of new construction has to meet. That's the physical structure itself. The reason that we decided to go with that model, and let's not get anything twisted here, we are a social services provider that is trying to do it through a different model. And the reason we went with tiny home, you kind of hit on it there, is one, the traditional facility is lacking in some ways. So not only from a sense of ownership standpoint, which is huge, I mean, it's huge in the rehabilitation process, but additionally, a lot of people deal with social anxiety issues. A lot of people deal with the idea of being secure in their own place. So the home, while it's extremely cost-effective to build, also provides those things. It provides sense of ownership with your surroundings and belongings, provides that security, provides a safe place, say, for counseling or evaluation that can be done inside that home. Additionally, it's a classroom to learn how to, you know, not merely learn, but remind yourself how to live independently again, how to, you know, cook your own meals again, how to store your own food again. All those things are extremely important to the process of rehabilitating yourself from the street into permanent housing.
I see. So it's really also kind of encompasses a complete circle of support, but including individual housing and programs to help them kind of reintegrate back into, if you will, the usual society, civilian society.
Mm-hmm.
What would you say are some of the challenges? And I ask this question maybe so you can share your experience with our listeners, because we've had other veteran groups on our show in prior months, and we hope to in the future as well. I'd like to use this show as a kind of a form of exchange of ideas. So what advice or insights could you share about kind of the process, the challenges you're going through in creating this Veterans Village and the concept of, you know, individual tiny homes for veterans?
So the thing that we receive a lot of inquiries weekly, just kind of in regard to how we were able to get a village of tiny homes allowed for with inside city limits, because we are well inside the core of Kansas City. That was extremely important to us. We're a few feet from a bus stop, which, you know, when we're talking about transitional housing and providing services, that means access to existing services, and those come inside a city center, as well as you got to learn how to use the bus to get to work, to the grocery store, what all that means. So being able to do something inside city limits, we get asked that question all the time. That was probably the biggest challenge. There's no map for how you build or allow for tiny homes inside major cities. For us, we started with a meeting in the mayor's office. We basically went to the mayor and the city council and said, this is the idea we have, and if you don't support us on this, we're dead in the water. Without your support, this isn't going to happen. Luckily for us, the city council in Kansas City was extremely supportive. The mayor, being a former Marine himself, was extremely supportive. They all continue to be extremely engaged in the process. And I think that was kind of the biggest hurdle, right? We couldn't look to somewhere else and say, well, this is how they did it. We've had to create it from scratch.
I think that's awesome that had the plan. Go ahead, Richard.
Yeah, Brian, as I'm listening to you describe the tiny homes and the housing, is it temporary housing for the veteran so that he starts out with you all and then once he's adjusted, he leaves and moves on to somewhere else? Or is this something that's more long-term?
No, I'm sorry. I should have. Sometimes I can skip over certain points, but one of the most important points is this is all transitional housing. It's not permanent housing. It wouldn't be suited for permanent housing. And by that, what I mean is, in addition to the 50 tiny homes, there will be a large community center on site. That community center is where case managers will work. It's where the laundry facilities will be. It's where the larger dining hall will be, medical room, veterinarian room, all of that. Because again, the idea is take someone from the street, put them in a position that they can be successful, get them back on their feet, and ultimately get them in a permanent housing solution. And that may mean home ownership, that may mean an apartment. It's going to be different for everybody because no single person has the same two issues generally, or three issues, or however many issues.
Taking someone from the street, how does a veteran get into the tiny home? I mean, when you say take someone from the street, are you literally taking them off the street and putting them in, or is this something that they move toward you through the VA, or how do they get to
No, so we are We are a private nonprofit organization. We, at this point, have not taken any sort of federal or state dollars to do what we're doing. That has to do with some of our programming and our mission, meaning we define veteran much more liberally than in or expansively than what federal grants allow for. So we are our own nonprofit entity. We conduct our own street outreach, and we make offers. Basically, we go out, interact with the veteran homeless community, and it's simply an offer to come stay. There's not an application process, which is for a few reasons. One, you wouldn't want somebody moving to the area just to try to get into the program. And two, you wouldn't want somebody putting themselves in a worse position in order to apply for the program. So it's all, at this time, going to be based off offers as opposed to applications.
That's awesome. You know, Dave and I represent a lot of veterans over the last 5-6 years in our law practice. We've got a lot of great stories about, you know, getting compensation for some of these vets. And I'm sure you've got some great stories about putting some of these homeless vets into your tiny homes. Can you share a couple with us?
Oh, so that's the other part of it. The other part of it is we won't be housing in this facility until December. Now that's because it was a big undertaking, meaning, you know, we've only been at this for just about a year and a half full time. It was nights and weekends for about a year before that. And we're basically trying to build a subdivision. Subdivisions are expensive. So we had to build the capacity to be able to undertake this project in terms of the sewer, water, electric lines, all of that. So I wish that I could share some solid transition success stories, but what I can say, what is a success story to me is the veterans, the currently street homeless veterans that we work with are the ones that we consulted when it came to what's wrong with the current models and would you be open to this type of model. One of those individuals is an Army veteran who's been on and off the streets for about 20 years and has almost kind of denied any housing offer or program offer that's been presented to him in those 20 years. However, he's agreed to come live in our facility. Additionally, we've been able to excite that community to the point that when we have volunteer days, we have groups of, literally street homeless veterans that come to our property and help us build these homes because they're excited about what this can be for them and for other people. I think especially because, you know, talking with a couple of the guys, they know that they're doing something that will not only provide them with success, but potentially, you know, one home could over years and years and years serve 10, 15, 20 different veterans. So
that's really great. Where I live in kind of central Florida, about an hour north of Tampa, about 3 miles down the road from me is what they call the Withlacoochee Trail. And on that trail, there's probably anywhere from 50 to 75 homeless veterans that live out in the woods there. And I periodically go out there and bring them supplies or talk to them or, you know, just carry on some conversation. And it's intriguing to me how many of them want nothing to do with what we would call a normal living situation. They like it in the woods. They're away from people. They're away from the government. And, you know, when I try to, you know, say, well, why don't you do something different, they just look at me and say, no, we're happy here. So yeah. I wish we had something like the tiny homes where you are to try to get these veterans, you know, because we just had that hurricane go through here. And I went out in the woods and pulled probably 13, 35, and 40 of them and got them in the shelters. But so it's really great what you're doing. And I really wish you all the best with that. How can our listeners get in touch with your organization and help you out?
So the best way to reach us is probably through our website, which is veteranscommunityproject.org. We also have a pretty active Facebook page, but I mean that's the best way. Again, I don't want to try to plug away, but as a nonprofit, we completely rely on the generosity of the public. A lot of people think we're a government program or operate off government grants, but we don't, because, as you just alluded to, there are many who are distrustful, if you will, of some of those programs, and we understand that. Even though we partner with a lot of government-funded organizations, we try to remain independent ourselves, because it allows us to, for lack of a better term, make common sense decisions instead of maybe having to make some decisions that are maybe bogged down by red tape, or allowed to kind of say yes and then figure out the other parts of it afterwards, which is part of the reason we wanted to start this.
What I think is intriguing, I'm a real fan of history too, but the history of Kansas City and its development, that Kansas City was also famous as far as residential neighborhood development, kind of the beautiful city planning concept, big impact in Kansas City, from my understanding, from my reading of history. So I think it's fascinating that your organization is doing something that's unique as far as creating this this veterans village with individual tiny homes, but also it sounds like it's all its own standalone community, which, as you said, will have kind of a community center with all sorts of needs and services. I also saw from your website, Brian, that when you mentioned earlier the location being important, close to bus lines, because a lot of these veterans presume they're homeless, they're not going to have their own cars, maybe they have bicycles, but you've worked out a free bus fare system with the Kansas City bus service. Is that correct?
It is, and it's something that we're extremely proud of, and again, we're really proud of the city and the community in general for stepping up to make this program happen. And what it means is, so we have, in addition to the village we're building, we also have what we call our Veteran Outreach Center. That Veteran Outreach Center allows for any veteran to walk in off the street and receive any number of services. Our kind of motto is never say no to a veteran in need, meaning if we have a veteran that comes in and they need something, we're going to figure out what that is, or we're going to do it ourselves. But the main draw to our building is the partnership we have with the local transportation authority, which allows for any veteran to receive a bus pass that allows them to ride the bus for free. That has been
awesome.
Yeah, I have seen veterans standing in the building crying over the difference that will make in their lives. I think a lot of people may take for granted what transportation means in day-to-day life and the barriers that could create. And we saw it working with the population, and luckily, again, we're in a supportive community that allowed us to have those conversations with the director of the KCATA and City Hall and say, what would this look like if we decided to invent this program that allowed veterans to ride the bus for free, any veteran? And it took a little while to get it done, but we did, and the program's been online for, I want to say, about somewhere between 90 and 120 days, but we've issued almost 3,000 bus passes.
So, wow. That's awesome, and that's something that perhaps I hope can be duplicated in other cities, because I know, like in our Tampa Bay area, Tampa, St. Pete, Clearwater, all the communities around it, transportation is a big issue. And at one of the homeless shelters I had the occasion to visit, one thing that struck me immediately was they had a bicycle rack that was just jammed full of bicycles, and that was the primary transportation for these veterans. But that's pretty tough, you know, in 95-degree heat in Florida, where you're having to pedal long distances, we're looking for a job or whatever. So having a free bus pass is an awesome idea. Well, we're rapidly drawing to a close for our show tonight. Brian, I'd really like to thank you for the great work that you and everyone in your organization are doing. And one more time, if you could share with our listeners your website, your phone number, how can people contact, how can people donate to your organization?
No problem. I'm always willing to share ways people can donate to us. The website is veteranscommunityproject.org. You can go there, and there is a tab to volunteer, to make donations. Our phone number is 816-599-6503. Additionally, you can send us an email from there. The best email is info@VCP, like Veterans Community Project, -KC.org. And I just want to give one more plug to one more thing, and that's, I think a lot of the response that we've gotten is simply because there's so many people out there that love and support veterans, and there's not a lot of ways for them to give back, at least on a very personal level, on a structural level. And I think all we are and all we've done is enable the community at large a new avenue to give back, and they've really done all the work. We've just kind of facilitated it. So I encourage anybody to do the same.
Very good. And, Brian, thank you so much for being on our show. You have an open invitation to come back on our show in the future whenever you'd like to. Just give me a call so we can keep our listeners updated on your project, so perhaps they can learn from them and duplicate them around the country. So thank you very much, and have a good rest of the evening.
Best of luck, Brian.
All right, thank you both so much.
Good job.
Thank you.
Thank you both so much for having me, and thanks for advocating on the behalf of veterans.
Oh, absolutely, and thank you.
All right, thank you.
Good night. Well, Richard, that certainly was interesting. It sounds like the Veterans
Community
Project.
That sure was. What a great group, and what a wonderful thing that they're doing there in Kansas City.
Yep. And again, for our listeners, their website is veteranscommunityproject.org. Veteranscommunityproject.org. Check it out. It's a great website. Learn more about their program, and hopefully you can donate to their charitable organization. Richard, I know we just have a few minutes left in the show, and we don't have a lot of time left to talk about our
upcoming
show.
I'd like to mention one thing, David.
Yes.
We were talking about it earlier today, and you know, many times we have these tips that we do on this show, and I think I have a tip that I want our veterans to be aware of. You know, if you're being represented by an attorney or a veteran service officer or an organization, and you get mail from the VA, and it will say in the at the end of the letter that it was copied to your lawyer, or your veteran organization, or the service officer. I'm telling the veterans tonight: do not assume that your representative, your attorney, is getting a copy of that letter. In the last 6 months, I've had at least a dozen or so situations where my client received a letter, assumed that I had received the letter, and then we didn't speak for a few weeks, over a month maybe, and I found out later on that they thought I had the letter. I never knew about the letter. My client got a little angry that I wasn't corresponding back to him or her, and then only to find they would find out that I didn't get the letter. And it can really create problems for the veteran. It creates communications issues between the representative and the veteran. Whether or not that's intentional by the VA, it's anyone's guess. But the bottom line is, veterans, if you get mail from the VA, and at the bottom of the correspondence it says that it was copied to your representative, call your representative up and tell them that you got that letter, you're making them aware of it. Usually, David, I think you'll agree that we get the mail from the VA about 2 to 3 weeks after the veteran does. So it's very important to stay in communication with your representative, because otherwise you can have all sorts of different issues and problems. And I ran into one today, and that's why I'm bringing it up. And my client actually was very annoyed that I hadn't gotten back to him in about 3 to 4 weeks, and it had to do with a decision. And he almost said he wanted to terminate me, only to find out that I never got a copy of that letter. So,
well, by terminate, I hope he didn't mean. Yeah, no, that's a great point. And it's not a problem that's limited to Florida, because in talking with an attorney we're going to have on the show next month, it's a problem that they see in Louisiana, their organization, the same thing where the veteran will get a copy and the attorney is not. But as we're running out of time tonight, I want to make one plug for next week's show. On our September 25th show, our special guest will be two of the directors of the Costs of War Project based at Brown University, Professor Catherine Lutz of Brown University and Professor Netta Crawford of Boston University. Cost of War Project is a large team of scholars, legal experts, human rights practitioners, physicians that began its work about 6 years ago to study, as the name suggests, the costs of war, both in human, cultural, social, and financial aspects. So they'll be our guests. I'm looking forward to it. It should be an outstanding show. As we're running out of time, Richard, if you'd like to perhaps remind us about the VA's very important coaching and care program before we conclude.
Love to, David. If you are a family member of a veteran who has left the service and is having a tough time transitioning to civilian life, please be aware of the VA's program called Coaching Into Care. It helps veterans having difficulty transitioning to home life. Returning home can be a tough adjustment, and loved ones can help. Coaching Into Care offers free coaching to help you help your veteran. Give the program a call, toll-free 1-888-823-7458. Its hours are Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Again, the VA's Coaching Into Care number is 1-888-823-7458. In addition, I would like to once again remind listeners that if you know a veteran who is suicidal or in a crisis of any kind, the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs also has the Veterans Crisis Line to help. Call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1. Many veterans have committed suicide because they didn't get the help they needed. Help them get the care they need to cope with their problems. Once again, the Veterans Crisis Line can help. Call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1. David?
We'd like to thank our show sponsors, including American Legion Post 303 of Bonita Springs, Florida, Mr. Charles M. Newman of Florida, and Corey and Hurley Law Group, which represents veterans and disability cases involving the VA. We'd like to thank our producer here at BBS Radio, Mr. Doug Newsom, and invite our listeners to become show guests, sponsors, and advertisers. Check out our website, bbsradio.com/TheVeteransNewsHour. You can also find archived podcasts of our prior shows for your benefit. Well, it's been another quick hour. I think it's been a very enjoyable interview with our special guest, Mr. Brian Meyer. So please tune in next week, same time, same station, for another edition of the Veterans News Hour. Until then, have a great week and good night.
Good night, David.
Good night.
Thank you for listening to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley. We hope you found this week's program very informative. Be sure to invite your friends and all the veterans you know to tune in next week when we'll have another great show on veterans issues. Meanwhile, you can listen to our other recorded episodes on the Veterans News Hour webpage on bbsradio.com. Thanks again for listening to the Veterans News Hour.